Deutsche Welle Africa Link.
And welcome to this edition of Africa Link. I'm Mark Caldwell in Bonn. Coming up, a summit in Chad announces the resignation of Michel Djotodia, president of the Central African Republic. The response back home in Bangui is overwhelming. We also have this pessimistic assessment of how the conflict in South Sudan might evolve.
We're going into a long-drawn civil war type of engagement between regular forces of the SPLA, with other armed groups now joining in more and more.
And as South Africans prepare for elections this year, we ask what is likely to be in the ANC's manifesto. Do stay with us.
Top story.
President Michel Djotodia and Prime Minister Nicolas Tiangai of the Central African Republic have stepped down after regional leaders held a two-day summit in neighbouring Chad. Benjamin Baramoto reports for DW's French service from the capital of the CAR.
Here in Bangui, the news has been received with joy among the population. Many people went out onto the streets to celebrate the resignation of President Michel Djotodia. They started celebrations this afternoon, and they could continue well into the night.
The whole of the Central African Republic's Transitional Assembly was flown to Chad for the summit. From the capital, N'Djamena, DW correspondent William Wang Creo explains why.
There are a large number of laws governing the Central African Republic. So before anyone decides to remove the president, there has to be a degree of legitimacy. And that legitimacy cannot exist if the interim parliament, which proposed the current constitution, has not been consulted.
The Central African Republic has been racked by violence between Seleka Muslim and anti-Balaka Christian militia, in which hundreds, if not thousands, have been killed. 1 million of the country's population of 4.5 million have been displaced. So will the departure of the interim leadership ease the tension? A question for Paul Melle, Associate Fellow with the Africa Programme at Chatham House in the UK.
The departure of Djotodia removes one problem, because he was installed in power by the Seleka militia, but had in effect lost any control over them. So he was more their pawn than a figure of authority. And at the same time, he was basically regarded as illegitimate by most other Central Africans, even though the African Union had endorsed him as a transitional head of state until elections. But that's only resolved one small facet of the problem, because they still have to choose a new head of state who can command broad legitimacy among a sufficient sort of section of the population, and hopefully among some Muslim Central Africans, as well as the larger proportion of the population who are Christian. And even if that person is selected, it doesn't solve the other problems. The widespread armed violence, the fact that Seleka remains a significant force in the country despite theoretically being confined to barracks, the upsurge of inter-ethnic mistrust, the fact that the Antibalaka, which was a movement that didn't really exist a few months ago but has just emerged, as it were, in reaction against Seleka, is now a very violent, very powerful collection of armed groups springing up in local communities in Bangui and in some provincial areas, and equally ready to use extreme violence. So none of those issues are solved.
Was this decision taken by the Transitional Assembly? Did they take this decision on their own, or was pressure brought to bear upon them by the Economic Community of Central African States, ECAS?
Well, pressure was mostly brought to bear by Chad, which organised and hosted the summit. The other ECAS countries haven't really said very much during this process. It's clearly President Idriss Déby in Chad who's driving this. And he has always regarded the CAR as a backyard, if you like, of for Chad's own interest. He doesn't want to see a completely destabilized CAR. He's very concerned about the risk of any development of radical Islam and fears that instability in the CAR might create a space in which that could develop among the Muslim community in the country. And he also clearly had concluded that Jotodjo was simply incapable of delivering even the most limited level of stability.
The rights group Amnesty International said on Friday there was an urgent need for more peacekeepers following the interim leadership's resignation. Do you share that view?
There obviously is an urgent need for more peacekeepers. And people in France, for example, political figures, have begun to ask, where is the rest of Europe and why should France do all this alone? And from an African point of view, it may be easier to motivate more African countries to join the peace operation if it is a larger affair with perhaps other European member states. And Catherine Ashton, the European Union foreign policy chief, has apparently drafted a document which suggests that other EU countries should contribute so that a battalion of 700 to 1,000 troops could be dispatched to the CAR to work alongside the French and the Africans. That would be quite helpful.
Paul Mellet from Chatham House.
Africa Link, bringing you the story behind the story.
In Addis Ababa on Friday, Sio Mesfin, the chief mediator in the talks between the South Sudanese government and the rebels, announced that he was optimistic that a ceasefire would be signed soon. However, there has been fresh fighting as government forces close in on the rebel-held town of Bentiu. Meanwhile, the United Nations, which is sheltering tens of thousands of people across the country, says the death toll is considerably higher than the 1,000 given so far. I've been talking to Peter Schumann, a former director of the UN mission in South Sudan, about the role of the world body during the conflict. It has been providing humanitarian relief. Has it also been trying to mediate between the warring factions?
Not really. The UN is more engaged at the local level, at their bases, where they are up to their ears engaged in assisting the increasing number of internally displaced people who desperately need shelter and protection from assaults from outside. The UN may be involved sort of at local talks, but not in others.
Why isn't the UN involved in mediation efforts?
Well, if you look back at the peace process, the UN did not engage itself in the peace process. It was an IGAD-led process where the UN played an observer and an advisory role. And in my view, the UN mission in Juba would be well advised to stay at this level and not to get engaged. You know, the UN mission's mandate at the moment is to assist the government, to work through the government. Even the protection mandate is to be implemented through the government. So if the UN now would get involved in political negotiations, they would need not only a new mandate, but they would need a completely new setup to perform these functions.
The Security Council has approved the sending of an extra 5,500 troops to South Sudan. What will be their role?
I'm very surprised that these troops are delayed. Initially, the head of peacekeeping announced within 3 weeks, because it's not new forces, not new police, new soldiers, but they had promised to simply transfer existing blue helmets from existing missions to Sudan. I fail to understand why this should now take 8 to 9 weeks. Number two, if they are taken from other missions where they perform more observation and monitoring tasks, they will not be equipped, they will not have the military capacity, the security capacity to really defend people on the imminent threat. So we will simply see more of the same, those people under threat who make it through the guarded doors and walls of UN compounds, who make it through the mission walls into the compound, may have some shelter, but outside, unfortunately, I must say, I have no information which convinces me that the UN is performing protection outside their mission walls.
Why was the UN unable to stop the fighting?
I think the UN never tried, and wisely so. The head of the UN operation, Hilde Johnson, stated on 26th of December very openly that she was totally surprised by what was happening. Now, You know, if you don't have the intelligence, if you don't have the analysis that there is a major conflict brewing, which we saw coming for months and months, if you're not, you haven't seen it coming, you were surprised, then this simply means that you have not organized your forces in a way to respond quickly. This needs an immediate response. Now we're seeing, you know, the daily report about the tactical fights here and there indicates we're going into a long-drawn civil war type of engagement between regular forces of the SPLA with other armed groups now joining in more and more.
Hilda Johnson was heavily involved in the comprehensive peace agreement that eventually led to the creation of the new state of South Sudan under Salva Kiir. Could it be that the UN has a problem in maintaining an image of strict neutrality in this conflict?
Well, there is no strict neutrality. If you look at the mandate, it very clearly stipulates the mission is there to support the government, which means to support the SPLM as the ruling party, the SPLA as the army, in whatever the government intends to do.
Peter Schumann, former director of the UN mission in South Sudan.
Human rights.
When the United Nations Human Rights Committee completed its Universal Periodic Review of Ghana in October 2012, it made a number of detailed proposals for the combating of homophobia, starting with the decriminalisation of same-sex relations between consenting adults. But 15 months later, despite these recommendations, gays and lesbians are still being hounded by the law and discriminated against. Some, though, are taking their courage and perhaps their lives into their hands and are speaking out about their sexual orientation. Isaac Kaledzi reports.
In Ghana, the topic of homosexuality is abhorred. Many do not talk about it. Those who do only speak against it. But a new group, the National Coalition for Proper Human, Sexual and Family Values, is trying to adopt a better approach towards tackling the issue. Moses Fuamuni is president of the coalition.
You know, of our objectives to help strengthen the network of organizations, both local and international, towards resolving this problem, and to engage in a forceful lobbying against LGBT rights activists, and to bring together experts to formulate a modern, comprehensive, solution-based legislation for dealing with abnormal sexual behavior and tendencies. And that's very critical for us.
He said the way to go is not to target gays and lesbians like Uganda is doing.
You know, Ghanaians, we do things well. It is not for nothing that we're the first country south of the Sahara to be independent. I know if you look at Uganda, I think they've gone to the extreme. The capital punishment for homosexuality. I don't think that's the approach.
Gays and lesbians fear for their lives and hardly show themselves up in public. But now, through this new move, they appear to be standing up to the challenge demanding the respect of their rights.
Sexuality causes so much discomfort and anxiety. Why does it get us all riled up?
And one of the things that struck me is...
At this evening party in Accra, many of the gays and lesbians who belong to the Coalition Against Homophobia in Ghana showed up to mingle and have fun, but also to show boldness about their sexuality. The event was organized by the cultural network Accra.alt. It hosts monthly events to support and encourage gays and lesbians to speak out and answer questions from the curious crowd about the challenge of being gay in Ghana. Fifi and Daniel, as they would like to be called, say their families know about their sexuality and appreciate them.
Home, everybody knows I'm gay. They know, like, they ask me, how do you sex, how do you kiss, how do you do this, how do you do that. I even teach them how to dance family dance.
Another gay, Stephen, confessed that he believes his sexuality is hereditary since it runs through the family.
My elder brother is a gay. My second brother is a gay. And it's like, my dad is a gay.
Ghana's laws are not clear on homosexuality. It only forbids having anal sex, but does not speak to same-sex marriage. Ghanaians say homosexuality is un-African and against all forms of religions. But some gays say the decision must be left to them to make, since no one has the right to decide what is best for them. But not all believe gays and lesbians must be left alone to do what they like. The president of the National Union of Ghana Students, Samuel Bimfo Dakwa, says Ghana's authorities must be bold and make laws that will forbid the act.
I believe that as a nation, we need to sit up about it. It is time we take a stand about it as a nation and be definite. We can't just, deceive ourselves, pretend as though things are right, but really are not right. Our legal system really is ambiguous about it.
But on the streets of Accra, Ghanaians seem to be accepting the fact that gays and lesbians ought not to be attacked, but taken through the right process if their sexuality offends the law.
The government should deal with them, take them to court and then talk to them. Don't beat them, but you should take them to court and then ask them questions about it. The reason why they are doing those things and all that.
I think that they shouldn't beat them, but they should look for other means of causing disgrace to them so that they will find it very difficult in engaging in such acts again.
It is obvious there are indications the Ghanaian society is beginning to accept that sexual orientation of people must be properly discussed. But it doesn't appear to be a friendly environment for gays and lesbians yet. Enough education will have to be carried out for such a result.
Isaac Kaledzi reporting from Accra. In South Africa on Friday evening, President Jacob Zuma was set to unveil the contents of the ANC election manifesto at a dinner attended by the party's financial backers. The manifesto will be officially made public at a rally on Saturday. I asked our correspondent in South Africa, Sobri Gabunda, what was expected to be in it.
Yes, Mark, the significant social and economic changes over the past 20 years in the lives of the previously disadvantaged majority will and is featured prominently in the election manifesto. The fact that all South Africans now had the right to free education and free health services and to climb to the highest rung of the ladder in all sectors of social and economic life is also emphasized. But against this, the manifesto points out that there is still a lot more to do in order to improve the lives of the vast majority of the people who have been left behind. Now, the following measures will be considered: the creation of more and more jobs, especially for the youth, the creation of conducive conditions for greater foreign investment in the country, the introduction of measures to tighten up safety and security for the people from the violent and spiraling crime rate, and to speed up measures to stem the growing inequality between the rich and poor.
Do you think this manifesto will go down well with South Africans?
The majority of the people who support the ANC and have voted it into power four times since 1994 no doubt will welcome the manifesto. But you know, there are also a lot of people who will use the manifesto to find faults and thereby try to make political gains. But of course, their criticism will not make much of an impact on those who support Jacob Zuma and the ANC. Although there are quite a few multiracial political organizations, much of the politics in South Africa is seen to a large extent on a racial basis and by people who act racially.
How much of a challenge is the ANC going to face from opposition parties?
Mark, you know, although there's a great deal of opposition and criticism of the ANC's shortcomings in many sectors of life, the party has got a solid hold on the majority of the people. Even the growing black middle class rely on the ANC for their jobs in government departments. Now, the newly established Economic Freedom Front of Julius Malema and the Hakang political party of former activist Dr. Ramphele Mamphele may take away some of the votes, especially the youth. The co-party of the former defense minister Musie Lekota and the official Democratic Alliance opposition will also gain some votes. But this, I think, will not be enough to challenge the ANC's hold on power. Its percentage win in the last elections of 65% may be reduced, but it will still obtain more than 50% to regain power for the next 5 years.
Our South Africa correspondent, Sobri Gavinda.
USA.
Let's hear now what our listeners and online readers have been saying about the stories we've been covering over the past week. Shortly before we went on the air, Abubakar Jolu joined me in the studio.
Before I begin with the responses, let me share the good news from our very own correspondent in Cameroon, Moki Kinseka. Moki is now a proud holder of Cameroon's top media award for journalists. He has received a Cameroon Academy Award named SONA as the 2013 Reporter of the Year for Excellence in Good Journalism. After the announcement, I called Moki up and this is what he had to say about the award.
I felt honored and satisfied, and I told myself that at least someone somewhere was listening to stories of the voiceless people and the downtrodden that I told in my report. But at the same time, I felt challenged to work harder. Truly, you are not sure of what will happen next to you as a reporter in my country. I have been harassed several times, arrested and locked up on a few occasions, and even received punitive transfers to work in the hinterlands. What motivates me is curiosity to be a learner, to learn as quickly, widely, deeply, and potentially as possible.
We here at Deutsche Welle are also extremely happy with and proud of your reporting, Moki. We look forward to more story ideas from you, as always.
Now, back to what you, the listeners, have been saying in response to our opinion question on Wednesday, Mark.
In Opinion this week, we asked for your thoughts on our story from Israel about African asylum seekers. Thousands of Africans have been protesting against Israel's immigration policy. These demonstrations have confronted Israel with key questions about its identity. Who is a refugee? And are Israelis under a special obligation to help others? What do you think?
Via text message from South Sudan, Peter Chumdeng wrote this message. Dear fellow Africans, you have protested against illegal detention and denial for refugee status in Israel. If nothing changes, please come back home. It is much better to die at your troubled home than to continue asking for help of which you have been denied. It seems Israel is not a place for you because the government doesn't want you there. I, however, appreciate that you are demonstrating peacefully and the rest of the world knows your plight by now. Please come back home. Also, another text message from Banyo, Adamawa State in Cameroon. Ahmed Usman wrote, I think 95% of the people demonstrating there are opportunists. Just a few of them are actual refugees. They should all come back home and create job opportunities for themselves, just like how people are doing it in Europe, China, the United States, and in the BRIC nations. That's all from me. Over to you, Mark.
Abubakar there with comments from our listeners here on Africa Link. Remember, if you'd like to tell us about something you've heard or would like to hear on this programme, then do send a text message to country code 491609575950. That's 491609575950. An email to feedback.africa@dw.de or a letter to Africa Link, DW 53110, Bonn, Germany. If you're a member of one of our listeners' clubs and wish to have your comments aired, then drop us a line with your phone number and we'll call you back. And of course, we're very interested to hear what you think of our coverage of African stories on our website, dw.de. There'll be another question for you in our opinion corner on Wednesday. Your say will, of course, be back again in 7 days' time. Before we go, a reminder of the main stories we've been covering for you in this edition of Africa Link. The interim president and prime minister of the Central African Republic have resigned. The move was announced after a summit of regional leaders in Chad. We've also been hearing about the chances of a peace settlement in South Sudan, about the discrimination of gays and lesbians in Ghana, and about the ANC's manifesto ahead of elections in South Africa later this year. There we end this edition of Africa Link. Crispin Wakideu will be here on Monday. Do join him if you can. Have a pleasant weekend from me, Mark Caldwell. Bye now.